Sandstone Theological Society presents Beyond the Summit, Changing Our Minds, recorded live at the 1988 Sandstone Theological Symposium, held August 17th through the 20th, 1988. We take you to the University Park Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Beyond the Summit, Changing Our Minds. An inspiration from this panel comes from Ed Firmage's Rennell Lecture, and that he presented last fall at the U. And I just wanted to read a couple of paragraphs. We possess within ourselves great fear and guilt. We project that fear, based upon guilt, outward. This externalization of evil is what I fear. I fear our fear. When national leaders see evil empires outside their own souls, the bully bullpens of their office are used to create national paranoia and hatred rather than understanding and love. This, more than objectively evil leaders and nations, more than economic causes of war, is what fuels arms racing and leads to war. What is necessary at first may seem more impossible to accomplish than the great advances in international law and domestic governance described before. For we must change our mind before we can change our law. And only after we have changed our mind will any change in law and government hold. Here, and far closer to the center, the worlds of psychology and spirituality appear. We'd like to welcome our panel members today. And I'm going to introduce them in order of their presentations. And we feel very honored to have Senator Frankie Moss with us. He's a United States Senator from Utah for 18 years. He was described by the media as soft-spoken, effective, honest, and tough, a man of principle. His friends, family, and staff think of him as sincere, kind, genuine, bright, down-to-earth. He authored two timely books, The Water Crisis and Too Old, Too Sick, Too Bad, and is presently an attorney and consultant. He just stepped down as chairman of Utahns United Against the Nuclear War. Where's it? I can't figure out where it's coming from. It's beautiful. Senator Moss was recently honored by the citizens of Utah for being one of the best senators in the United States, having passed legislation that benefits all of us today. He was and still is the champion of the consumer, as evidenced by the fact that the Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act is still in existence. Consider childproof caps, safe toys, cigarette commercials no longer on TV. In 1976, Senator Moss made Senate history by going undercover, dressing as a bum, to expose abuses and fraud in the Medicaid clinics of New York City. I was living in Norway at the time, and the story hit the front page of the newspaper in Oslo. When I sent the clipping to Senator Moss, he wrote back, "That's interesting to see me written up in the Norwegian papers when I couldn't even get in the Tribune or Deseret News." Senator, we are delighted to have you with us today. Donna L. Kitty is a graphic artist and illustrator in Salt Lake City. Her PR background was the catalyst for her first connection with the peace movement, in which she helped Tom Johnson put together his story of the Great Peace March in 1986. The day the marchers arrived in Washington, Donna organized Utahns in Salt Lake City for a support walk, which 1,000 people attended. That was in November of 1986. Last year, Donna was one of 13 Utahns who participated in the American-Soviet peace walk in the Soviet Union. She will present slides from her walk. These slides were taken by Shelley White, who left just this week for the Soviet Union for the second Soviet-American peace walk. She was joined by two other members of Utahns United Against the Nuclear War. In the fall, some of these slides will be presented by the Utah Symphony, accompanied with music for their educational and children's programs. Gretchen, I'm not going to say it right, Met? You do say the K. Okay. Gretchen Connect Clark was born and educated in Boston. She attended BYU and more recently the University of Utah, where she is completing her master's degree in history. Her area of interest in modern Europe is in modern Europe, particularly Hitler Germany. She is married to Paul Clark and has six children, five of whom are living. as a result of the death of one son 7.5 years ago due to a car accident involving a drunken driver, Gretchen founded Parents Against Drunk Drivers. More recently, she has been involved in Utahns United Against the Nuclear Arms Race, serving as president for 2 years. She is also a member of Women Concerned About Nuclear War. At different times, she has hosted a delegation of women from the Soviet Union and a woman physician from Moscow. She has spoken throughout the state to LDS firesides, focusing on our brotherhood, sisterhood, most particularly with Soviet citizens. Her LDS church service competes with Ezra Taft Benson's and her travels with Charles Kuralt. Karen Anderson England grew up in Alpine, Utah, and fulfilled a mission in Georgia. At Utah State, she received her BA in English with an emphasis in women's literature. She is presently a part-time faculty member of the English department at BYU and is married to Mark England. I've been told that her talents are in teaching, and she has a good rapport and natural way with her students. She has been especially effective with high school age youth with problems. We congratulate Karen for graduating last week with a master's degree in English. And finally, Eugene England. Being such a prolific writer and lecturer, we may ask, what don't we know about Eugene England? A member of his family leaked the tidbit that while growing up in Downey, Idaho, he loved to play Tarzan. We can now visualize Dr. England in shorts with his favorite Tarzan knife swinging in the trees. After this adventurous youth, he graduated from the University of Utah, MIT, and then Stanford University, receiving his PhD. Lately, he has been in England researching the healing aspects of Shakespearean literature. He is author of 3 books, one on Brigham Young, Dialogues with Myself, and Why the Church is True as the Gospel. Perhaps more relevant is Dr. England's founding of Food for Poland, a humanitarian effort of Herculean proportions. These pioneer endeavors paved the way for the church's involvement in the community by recently giving large cash donations to soup kitchens and buildings for the homeless. On an international level, we rejoice in the church's humanitarian projects, immunizations, irrigation, and donations of medicine, food, and clothing. One cannot help but think of the forerunner, Dr. England, who encouraged fasting and giving when overseeing Food for Poland. He continues to inspire us with his focus of peace and Christ. We'd like to welcome all the panel members. I'd like to mention one more item before turning the time over to Senator Moss. He told me prior to this session that he may have to leave a little early to attend a funeral of a good friend. Senator Moss is a supporter of Sunstone and the symposia. Last year, I saw him buying a tape and slipping it in his pocket. I went over to him, and he took out the tape and showed it to me, giving a little laugh. It was Dr. England's paper that he delivered last year, Why Mormons Should Be Democrats.
Well, thank you, Barbara. I wish I had copied that introduction. It's the finest one I've received in a good many years, anyway. I'm very pleased to be here and very pleased that this section of the symposium was organized and put together by Barbara. I really am impressed to be a member of this panel. As each has been introduced, you find their backgrounds and knowledge and efforts have been so widespread and so valuable to all of us. And I'm very honored that I could participate at all. My participation will be rather brief because I know that each one of these who will follow have a great message, and I don't want to infringe any on the time. I want you to have the opportunity to hear each of them. This symposium called Beyond the Summit is indicative of the fact that we are moving in, I think, a good direction. At least we are taking a step in our relationships with the Soviet Union and other nations on this fragile globe that we all inherit. It was on the 6th of August, 1965, that 1945, that the whole world changed. But it's taken us all of this time really to absorb that change, and in some places we haven't absorbed it yet. That was when the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, and war became obsolete. But because of the long history of mankind ingrained in us, and because of the stubbornness of some of our leadership here and abroad, we have not yet fully absorbed that fact that war is obsolete. The nuclear bomb made war so terrible that no sane leader or group would advocate its use. And yet, we have not devised yet fully how we can get along without it. We are so fearful of one another that we keep building and building and building. We have over 50,000 nuclear warheads now. Soviet Union has approximately the same number, about 40,000 nuclear warheads. And if just 10% of those were used, could clean off the whole continent. Mankind could be exterminated. And under these circumstances, we had better turn our attention to building confidence, building bridges, being able to understand one another, and overcoming this nuclear arms race. And as Barbara indicated in her introduction, there are those who spend their time trying to bring attention to the nuclear arms race and to see what can be done to overcome it. Ed Firmage did a tremendous job in writing his book, or booklet. It was a Reynolds lecture, and I was so struck with it, and I talked with Ed, that we thought we'd devise a way maybe of communicating with the Congress, where a lot of the power lies, and see if we could get through some of his message. And you ladies will like this. We decided that so many things come into a senator or a congressman's office, and they land in the mail room and they get shuffled around and they're put in a pigeonhole or they're sent to some staffer, and the senator or congressman doesn't even know about them many times. So we thought we'd have another device. What we got was a mailing list of the wives of senators and congressmen, and wrote a letter signed by my wife Phyllis and Norma Matheson, in which they said this is a woman-to-woman communication. Women have a tendency, because of their nurturing nature, their care of children, the household maintenance, have a real concern about nuclear war. And here is a book that ought to be read. Will you read it? Speaking to the woman, will you read it? And then will you pass it to your husband? Now, we had few female members, so we had to have a little deviation on that. Pass it to your husband and ask him to read it. And perhaps you could indulge in a little pillow talk. Well, no way to measure what that has done, except that we think we're carrying through some of this educational effort. of the horrors, the absolute unbelievable horror of nuclear exchange, and the peril that we're in if it is ever utilized. And even though we balance off fairly well now with the Soviet Union and the kind of leadership that they apparently have, the genie is out of the bottle. Other people, other nations have the weapon. And should some madman or some country thinking it was an extremist resort to it, there's no assurance that it won't get out of hand. And that is what we're very much concerned about. Well, now in this symposium, which we discuss Mormon topics and how the Mormon people react to the world in which we live, we find that we are not very far ahead of the rest of the world in our acceptance. We tend to have this prejudice against those whom we feel are threatening us in some way. We went through that awful period of time when of McCarthyism, when the simple way to destroy a person was to say he was soft on communism or he was a pinko, and that destroyed him politically and somewhat socially. And now we hope that we've come around the corner to where we accept every human being as an equal, someone with whom we can communicate, and someone with enough intelligence to understand what we envision as the life on earth here to entail, and how we must react to one another. In reading a little on this, I came to this quote from Brigham Young's Discourses, which is a reliable source. A large share of the ingenuity of the world is taxed to invent weapons of war. Well, this is back in 1860, I don't know exactly the date, but it's in Brigham Young's lifetime. Anyway, what a set of fools. Much of the skill and ingenuity and ability of the Christian nations are now devoted to manufacturing instruments of death. Nobody even thought about the atomic bomb then. May we be saved from the effects of death. May we be saved from the effects of them. As I often tell you, we are faithful. The Lord will fight our battles much better than we can do ourselves. So we are not in a new cause. We're in an old cause, but one that has been stepped up in its magnitude and in its intensity to where it has no other conclusion other than we must halt the increase and the spread of nuclear weapons and in some way decrease or ultimately eliminate them. Right now, the Soviet Union over here attending tests of weapons down in Nevada. And they say it's great success. Well, why are we still testing? We already have weapons that can destroy the whole globe. And the only reason for this comparative testing is to say whether we can tell by our seismographs how big a one they're testing, and they can tell by their seismographs how big a one we're testing. Why do we need bigger ones? Why do we need them? Well, we have some cause for hope. Some cause for hope in that finally our leaders are communicating back and forth and exchanging some information. We've made a small step in the INF treaty to eliminate one small class of nuclear weapons, but that's all. I first went to the Soviet Union in 1959, and that was the time of Mr. Khrushchev. And he was opening up for the very first time for Americans to even get in there. Even the people at the embassy were circumscribed to an area. I remember vividly, I was just a young guy, I guess it was my first year in the Senate. And I was apprehensive of how I could communicate with the Soviets. So one thing I wanted as we began this tour, we went all around the Soviet Union, clear out to Lake Baikal and clear down on the Black Sea and up to Leningrad. I was concerned because we had to have an interpreter, obviously. She was very, very good, but I couldn't tell whether she was saying the same thing the person who was being interviewed. And there was a young fellow named George Winters who was doing his second tour in the Soviet Union. And he was a boy from Denver, by the way. And he was fluent in Russian. He could talk Russian. So I said, well, I've got to have a filter. I've got to have somebody who can tell me if what they're telling me is real. And so I said, okay, we take George with us. Oh, no. This just caused consternation. You see, everything was all wired in tight. And George, having completed his second tour over there, just completing his second, had never been permitted to go more than 100 miles around Moscow. That was the absolute limit. And we were going to go on a big trip all over the Soviet Union, so that wasn't so. We had to go up to the minister down. We spent 2.5 days negotiating on that, and I finally just threatened to walk out. I said, go, we're going to leave, and we're just going to say that we did not get cooperation from the Soviet. Oh, no, don't do that. Don't do that. They keep saying, you know, we just want to be sure. You know, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. I don't know how they got that all the time. Eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And so I threatened that. We took off for Tbilisi, and when we got out to the airport that morning, I said to Glauchkin, I said, where's Winters? Oh, well, we couldn't get cleared. And I said, look, we want our tickets out of Tbilisi to go home if Winters doesn't come. Oh, I'll go see the minister again. Well, it had a good outcome because that night when we finished going to the opera, they always take you to the opera, and I came in to my room in Tbilisi. There was George Winters. And George went with us, and he was just overjoyed. He got to see things he hadn't been able to see in 8 years. Not only that, he had a camera. And he had to be careful with that camera. You couldn't take any pictures of locks or railroads or transportation. But if you just want to take a peasant's building, home, that's all right. George had that camera, and he just reveled in that. He said, look, they're not going to ever believe me when they get back. Well, the whole point of the story is it was a beginning of the opening. And then Khrushchev was made a non-person, and we went back into the freeze. Now we're coming out again. Let's hope we can stay out in the sunshine, talk to one another. And the fact that our friends are over there walking again in the Soviet Union as they did before, and that the Soviets are walking here as they have done before, it seems to me is a great portent for the future. And out of that springs this hope that we will finally establish communication, respect, understanding, and begin to have in this globe, on this spaceship Earth, have the kind of freedom and exchange that mankind should have. Thank you.
Donna Kitty. I'm very pleased to be here today. And I thought I would like to start out with faces of the Soviet people so everyone could sort of meet them as I did. A little takeoff on what Senator Moss was saying. We were warned that we wouldn't be able to take pictures of much. We took pictures of everything, and it was great. So join with me in some slides briefly, and then I'll talk a bit after that. Lights?
Searching eyes try to find their way. Everything's fresh in a world without names. The darkness will come when in sight of our games. Oh, those games we play. Echoes of our care will last forever. Echoes of our care. Echoes of our care will last forever. Echoes of our care. Oh, no, 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 no. So much to explore. Rotten, wrong, decreed by parents of thought. Learning by living through protection and a care. As we mold the light through our words and our stares. In the things that we share. Open up and share. Cause echoes of our care will last forever. Echoes of our care. Echoes of our care will last forever. Echoes of our care. Echoes of our care will last forever. Echoes of our care. Echoes of our care will last forever. Echoes of our care.
This was a common sight in an American meeting, a Soviet. And what I was impressed with was the very deep exchange the level on which we met each other was way more profound than I had expected. I thought we would have some timid hellos and maybe some downcast eyes, and on the contrary, it was like meeting your best friend and your grandmama thousands of times over, all through the country. I did have some reservations about going, though I was excited to be going. I thought, is this really going to do anything? How can we build bridges? And then I realized that it was the effort and the sincerity of our hearts that was going to make a difference over there. We were 230 Americans walking with 230 Soviets from Leningrad to Moscow. That's about 500 miles. We basically lived together on buses and in camps. And some of the Soviets at the end of the walk said that they felt like they'd been to America for being on the buses with us. My Russian is way less than I had hoped it could be. So actually having conversations with words was hard for me, but the whole time I felt this underlying deep spirit. And they used the word spiritual a lot, and they referred to God. Now, I was told I would never hear that word over there. People are very aware of divine presence. And their morality, their integrity is inspiring. The only weapons we saw was, this is a ceremony which is changing the guards at Lenin's tomb. Even the policemen did not carry guns there. About the third day, we came into the city of Novgorod. 30,000 people came out to say hello. Another 50,000 people lined the streets and chanted to us Mir i Druzhba, which means peace and friendship. We were overwhelmed daily. There were tears constantly. And I began to think, maybe we're walking in the wrong country. I mean, these people really know the horrors of war. Every time we stopped, we were taken to a war memorial and reminded of the war. I have something that Gorbachev wrote to the walkers. I'm sorry, I don't seem to have it right in front of me. I can paraphrase. He sent a letter to the organizers of the American Peace Walk and said, please pass this along to all the walkers who came to our country. He said, in essence, that it is time to beat the swords into plowshares. That was right in the quote. To change our priorities, to move beyond a nuclear time. He thanked us profusely for coming over there. And he said that his country solely supported such demonstrations, such contact between the two countries, that we might change the word enemy into friend. I had heard that Russia was in a pretty arid place. This was a campsite. A woman that went with me took the pictures. We were on a rigid schedule. There was very little time for sleep, and if you had the chance, you felt you might miss something. So basically, we stayed up many, many hours and got together with as many kinds of people as we could possibly be with. Americans were invited into Soviet homes, and you know, the only hesitation I felt from the Soviet people was a little embarrassment sometimes that their home might not be nice enough. It was never an unwelcome feeling for us. This is an incredible shot because this is the American flag and the Soviet flag and peace walkers walking around the Kremlin. which they said we couldn't do, and we said, we came over here to do this. So they said, we'll arrest you, and we said, go ahead. And we did it, and it was a wonderful day. We planted trees everywhere we stopped. This was a concert that we gave. American artists came over and joined with Soviet wonderful folk artists in the last days. Actually, this was on 4th of July in Moscow. Every day was a day like this or this. Leaving was very difficult. This is a Soviet woman that you're looking at holding an American. And we have since written many letters and stayed in contact. And I mean, we had no ideas if our letters were really going to get there or not after having left. And it's encouraging to know that they did. Lights? Does anybody buy a light switch? Okay. I want to say that I'm very encouraged about the steps that are being made between the two countries and the fact that our president actually went over there, and I read a little statement as he stood in Red Square that said, this is the last place in my life that I thought I would be. And it seemed to be a good connection there. I only hope and pray that with Spirit's help that these channels can stay open and we can build some real things, some real bridges, and be humanity on a globe rather than us and them. Really walk these bridges and keep them open. Thank you.
I hope you were as pleased with those pictures as I was. I had the privilege of being in the Soviet Union in 1965, and I can tell you that there is a vast difference between what we saw and see on those people and what I saw in the way of dress and so forth. The homes in the countryside were the same, but I have been impressed that they are progressing, as behind us, definitely they are. I'm pleased with that. My own experience in this issue is about 5 years of duration, and it was precipitated by a number of things. I don't feel today that you're going to have perhaps facts and figures that you might have wanted, but I believe that those are very available, and I think that some of our experiences perhaps are rare. My own entrance into the issue came after I had returned to the University of Utah and taken history as my study. And after a number of years of becoming a student of European history, I had a lot of reevaluating to do. I grew up in that Second World War time when patriotism consisted partially of putting flags on the maps of the world at night as we watched our armies move through the Eastern and the Western fronts and the theaters of war in Europe and Asia. I recall very plainly friends and parents of friends being involved in the Korean War. And I had that definite sense that there is reason to go to war to fight for right, and that in war there is a right and there is a wrong. Always evident. I discovered that is not always the case. There's a blurring sometimes into economic and social impacts, prejudices, etc., etc. Border disputes and so forth can precipitate war. I had to stop and think. And in that experience, I would cite three things that were standouts that moved me from being I've got my hand in my pocket, being an armed American who often, with family, dropped bombs in various places of the country. We ought to go in there and drop a bomb. It was common at our dinner table. And finally, my start was one night when I said, I'm uncomfortable when we say that. Could we stop that? At least that statement, could we stop during dinner? And then it was a step-by-step. Donna walked the Soviet Union. I walked through paces as we do. Nationalism. I began to understand through my studies that nationalism is an overwrought patriotism. And it can be very dangerous. And it itself brought about many of our problems of hegemony and so forth through the 19th and 20th century. Nationalism, it's different than patriotism, caring for your country, wanting to serve it for its best, bring it to its best capacities as we attempt in even in our own lives. I learned that, and this was the most startling and perhaps one of the most instructive things. Invariably, and then challenge you to go and study and see if you find it. Invariably, in during the arousing period, the pre-war periods, invariably there is a voice of warning. Someone could see what was going to happen if the course that a nation was pursuing continued to its nth degree. And that voice was raised. I was impressed with that again and again, and I began to envision this voice as one of the marvelous voices of a symphonic piece that echoes higher, above the rest, with a dominant theme, attempting to be heard, often amidst great riotous and tumultuous anger. I found a voice like that in my own world. I found the voices of Ed and Gloria Firmage as they were in our own community attempting to forestall the establishment of a mobile MX basing system in our state. And I heard people talk about them in a very angry way. Why do they think they know more than governments? How many times do we hear that in America? Who says you know more than Washington? That's a challenge. That's a challenge. And as Americans, deep in my heart, with my New England background and my father, who was an instrument in town meetings process, I know the greatest danger we will ever face in this nation is the loss of dialogue between citizen and governed. A far greater danger than an outward and then an invasion of an enemy. I heard their voice, and I began to listen, and I thought, aha! This is my voice from the symphony, from the cacophony of sound. I'm hearing a voice. I listen to it. And I joined them in their group, Utahns United Against the Nuclear Arms Race. And in that day, 5 years ago, it was a very small group, and it was only a few months before I found myself acting as president, serving with a retired Marine Corps general. And my education began, and my mind again had to change. I couldn't get the terminology off my tongue. I mean, you try overnight to discuss MIRVing and launch on warning and ICBMs and ABMs and warheads and MIRVing and all of that. Try it. And then the press sticks the mic in front of your face and says, what do you think about this? And I'm saying, I finally learned to bring it down to this. There is with Ed Firmage as a mentor, I learned there is a qualitative arms race that has to do with testing. If you want to stop the qualitative, the improvement constantly to new weaponry, slow down the qualitative arms race. If you want to halt the vast numbers and the storage of nuclear weapons, which perhaps are political weapons and may never be used, then slow down the quantitative arms race. Why do we need to make 1,500 new warheads every single year when we already have 40,000 and 50,000 in storage? Bullets you may need to store, but nuclear warheads, I'm not so sure. And then the horizontal arm race, where this is going to stop the proliferation. There's a need to stop the proliferation so that this material doesn't get into the hands. I'm not as worried about Russia threatening an attack on us as I am others who have less schooling and training in diplomacy. Those were the things I learned, but I still wasn't totally comfortable. That's a rational argument, and if you get in a rational argument, someone else can always out-argue you. Right. So I searched around in this issue for my comfort zone, where all of my senses, all of me, could be drawn in, and I found it. I found it in Eugene England's material. I found it in Ed Firmage's material. I found it in the material of non-LDS people who sensed a need to turn to Christ. It's there. It's so plain. It's so simple. And it has been there. Trust God. He will fight your battles if you need to fight battles. Christ would say, love your enemy, and then you have no need of battles. Those were the messages that filled my mind, my heart, and my soul, and brought me to an integrity of self. Because the challenge is, ho, 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 do that for the Soviet Union over there. Well, I can do that all day long. I can apply all that to the Soviet Union or to some other enemy of a geopolitical kind of nature far away from home. But can I, within my own life and my own sphere, love my enemy and do good to that one who would hurt me or despitefully use me? And there are in this movement marvelous people who are so committed to nonviolence that they will lie down in front of the white train that travels this nation when it is going to the Trident Seattle. And they have a commitment to peace and nonviolence that when I have seen it and heard it in their words and seen it on their faces, that I shied away from. I thought I was peaceful. I didn't have that kind of peace. I learned it. I learned to want to love every man and to consider that every individual, no matter where I found him and what condition of life, was truly my brother, my sister. I would walk down the street and see people with whom I might not want to sit down and talk, and in my head I would say, "You are my brother." And I was surprised how often our eyes would meet, and something inside me expanded. All right, that was my challenge. Have you ever given yourself a challenge and wait for you to have the test? I took the challenge, and I got the test. Let me briefly describe. A Soviet guest, a woman. A group of women came to America, not as a delegation representing any agency. Women from all over the Soviet Union came to America, visited in 13 cities, groups of four, stayed in homes. Unprecedented, historical. The woman who came to me, because one wasn't able to be the fourth in the group coming to Salt Lake, I had a single woman come, a woman come alone. I knew immediately she was trusted or she would not be living alone with me. 3 days we spent together. I was committed and had told myself, "I will not be fooled by you. We disagree ideologically, but I will show you love. You will leave my home feeling me and my sense of spirit and my love. But I'm not going to be fooled." So I had the door. I had my defenses up. 3 days we spent together. Let me tell you of three different things that happened. These, remember, are from the evil empire, totally godless. Right? Right. We've been told that for years. I stood in a room with a poster of Jesus, of the head of Christ, on the wall. It was one of my kids' posters, and I was putting her in that room, and I said to myself, "Take it down, leave it up, take it down, leave it up." I said, "Nuts, I'll leave it up. She won't even know who it is." The morning after her first day, her first statement in the car is, "I liked your Christus." Oh. And I said, "I'm glad you liked that. He is important to me. I believe he is the Savior of all mankind and truly the Son of God on earth." She didn't argue with me. She sat with her hands folded quietly. We had these marvelous days. Think of VIP, the governor, the LDS church, the mayor, the open houses at the Fine Arts Museum. We did a red carpet, the likes of which I would one time enjoy in this city. And it was a wonderful, hectic, marvelous kind of female visiting together. They were keynotes at Orrin Hatch's women's conference. At the end of a long evening, she came in, and I knew she had been seeing things, and I could sense with her first statement to me, "I like your Christus," I knew, wait a minute, we've got something here. That night, she turned to me, and she said, "I've seen a lot. I've had a wonderful day. Life is good here. But it is a shame that you Americans are so wicked and so evil to all people on the face of the earth but yourselves. You have so much," she said as she looked around my kitchen. She had seen how much we have. And she dumped on me, and I stood there aghast, and I was silent. I thought, what do I do now? Begin at 10:30 at night an ideological discussion that cannot come to any kind of logical sense? The thoughts went through my mind. Her motivations went through my mind. I stood looking at her, and I looked at her, and I surprised myself with these words, "Larissa, I love you, and I think it's time we both went to bed." I was rather surprised. I hadn't truly considered that I loved her, but at that moment, my sense for her, my feeling for her, was as horizontal and close as for my own dear sister. The next morning, there was a total difference. and the end, the visit came. We took her for 5 minutes. I was not intending to do any LDS missionary work. Believe me, I was going to stand off and be myself and let her feel what she could from me. We took her to the information center. We had 5 minutes. She saw the Christus and she said, "Why is his head down? In yours it is up. Why down?" It troubled her. And I said, "He is looking and reaching, Larissa. He is reaching. He is our teacher." "Oh." And I again told her what he means to me. And we walked on. Quick discussion. As we were leaving to go to the Tabernacle Choir broadcast, Paul suggested we get her a Book of Mormon in Russian, which the guide said she couldn't have, and he said, "Get it anyway." She said, "It's okay." We gave it to her. And while they were doing that, I said something else to her. She turned her back on all of them, looked me straight in the eye. She had asked where our Last Supper picture was. She looked me straight in the eye, and she said, "Gretchen, I believe..." And I thought, evil empire, godless people. All I could think was, my word, what conflict does this woman live with in her soul to survive where she was born? The Tabernacle broadcast, walking out of the Tabernacle, she said, "Gretchen," holding my hand, tears streaming down our faces as the choir sang, "God be with you till we meet again." And she leaned over and said, "I know this one." And again I thought, what? Evil empire, godless society, what do I have here? And when she walked down the aisle, she said, "If I could start every day of my life in this way, with this sound and this feeling that I have in my soul, life would truly be totally beautiful." Her parting words at the airport, "I don't," and the others echoed it, "we don't need to see the rest of America. If we could do what we wanted, we would simply stay here with you." They backed out the ramp, laden with goods, tears streaming down their faces, and waving goodbye. I realized that I had taken the challenge to love my enemies, to do good to those who would hate me and despitefully use me. And I had found that there is love within my enemy for her enemy. And she would do good to me, thinking that my system might despitefully use her. She gave me an amber necklace, marvelous piece, and saying, "I have worn this on my heart. I would like to know that you would wear it over yours." When it comes to poetry and giving, they do know how to do it. Let me conclude with this surprise. As I have gone on in the issue for the last 3 or 4 years, burning out, so glad to see the Donna Kitties come along in the second generation, the grassroots, the mindset change. I'm not a radical and a liberal anymore, but I was just 2 to 3 years ago in this community because of my espousals. People now don't look at me and they say, "Why do you call yourself that?" I say, "Because folks like you used to call me that. I learned it from you, not from me." Let me give you my surprise. While I thank Eugene England and Ed Firmage and those kinds of minds for leading me on the greatest adventure of my life, 5 years ago I entered into the most dynamic, warlike, hate-filled issue of our times, perhaps of the whole history of the world, because it encompasses the world. I entered into that issue expecting to do battle, heard the words of Christ, heard the words of the prophets, read them, the materials are so available. Bibliographies are able. I'll give them to you if you ask. I entered into that battle, and I stand before you today, someone who, because of my activity, has been healed totally and completely of any warlikeness that I once had within me, as President Kimball so describes us. Having been healed of angers, having learned, because I learned to deal with this issue with confrontation, I don't get angry anymore. Why? Because I don't like the feeling. Why? Because I've learned the other feeling, the peaceful, wonderful, Christ-like feeling, and I don't want the other within my soul, mind, or body. I cannot bear to have it with me. How could that have been when that the nature of this issue is what it is? How could I stand here and say that experience healed my war-torn soul? And my hate-filled soul that believed in geopolitical boundaries, because that's what the books told me about. And let me leave you with this commitment that is now written in my soul. From 2 Nephi 4, O Lord, I have trusted in thee, and I will trust in thee forever. I will not put my trust in the arm of flesh, parentheses weaponry. For I know that cursed is he that putteth his trust in the arm of flesh. Yea, cursed is he that putteth his trust in man and maketh flesh. Thank you very much.
I apologize for some formality. I've never participated in one of these and wasn't quite sure what to expect, but I'd like to talk for a few minutes about Nadine Anderson, who is a very close personal friend. She begins her duties as director of nurses at Heritage Convalescent Center every morning at 6 o'clock. First on her schedule is to make early rounds, the official purpose of which is to administer necessary medications. A more vital purpose, however, one that is not on her list of professional duties, is to visit each patient, to spend a few minutes each with 60 people who are in the final years, weeks, sometimes hours of their lives. The patients there, who still remember their time and their place, return her straightforward and personal love with warmth and gratitude. They hold her as a friend, a confidant, and sister. Others, lost in ancient childhoods, turn to her to mediate their squabbles and soothe their fears. Those consumed by loss and terror halt their rages and obscenities at her reassurance. Those so near their cyclic ends that they resemble tiny infants in very large beds, calm at her touch and at her presence. She sees them suffer, and I know that she suffers with them. I think that by her nature and profession, she understands the efficacy of death, yet her convictions are bent on preserving life, and not only on preserving it, but on soothing it and comforting it and softening it. I've heard many people ask her how she can let a suffering remnant or piece of life continue. Nadine agrees that death will bring relief, but she will not cause it in any way. She will relieve pain, terror, loneliness, and hunger as long as the life continues. I've seen families come into her and ask with surprising frequency that their suffering, debilitated parents receive no more care than a roof and a bed. And my friend says that she will draw the line at starving a human being, no matter how much suffering is present. Although I don't think that Nadine has read Cynthia Ozick, her life and work reverberate with Ozick's meaning when she says, implicit in redemption is everything against the fated or the static, everything that hates death and harm and elevates the life-giving, if only through terror at its absence. I once watched Nadine Anderson coax a shriveled woman, determined to be listless, sure to die before the week was out, from her bed to a window to see the summer leaves. I've watched her feed old, surly men, spoon after spoon of pureed hospital food, somehow preserving the dignity for which they would rather starve than lose. I watched her lift a tiny 60-pound corpse from a wheelchair back into its bed, closing its eyes and drawing sheets and curtains to ensure its lifeless comfort until the morticians arrived. I've seen her cry at the loss of many whom she has hoped and known would die to relieve them from their suffering. Nursing and mothering to this woman are parts of the same urge to care, to create and sustain relationships. And although there are masculine roles which I know demand similar qualities, the manner and degree to which Nadine and all of our mothers have carried them is in our culture and in most cultures distinctly feminine. It's a psyche in which morality at its very essence is responsibility for other life. I cannot presume that such women have the answers to national or personal conflicts any more than men do, but it does seem clear that many of the positive, regenerative attitudes traditionally ascribed to women have been viewed as relevant only in the private sphere and have been seen as idealistic and irrational in the more masculine world of politics. This may be one reason why the history of mankind is a history of war. The history of womankind, although it has absurdities of its own, is not a history of war. Obviously, there are too many reasons for this to analyze it. It has been suggested that the emotional and biological ties to childbirth give women an aversion to their opposites in any form. Another more cynical explanation is that women do not participate in wars or violent conflicts because men do it for them. None of us really knows. But since a predominantly masculine world of politics has as yet failed to eliminate threatening conflict, it seems valuable to open up the global conversation, to consider the feminine voices in all of us, and to validate them beyond the usual indulgence we give to our mothers and grandmothers, to look to them for solutions to our military crises. Carol Gilligan of Harvard University researched fundamental differences in male and female patterns of moral development and moral decision-making for her book, In a Different Voice. She noticed at the outset that when women of any age were measured for moral maturity against scales created by Freud, Piaget, Kohlberg, and other prominent developmental theorists, that they consistently registered as abnormal, that women were far behind their male counterparts in their capacity to make proper moral decisions. It is not surprising that further research showed discrepancies in the developmental theories rather than in the general morality of women. Kohlberg, for example, delineated 6 stages of moral development from a 20-year study of 84 boys. No girls were included in his study. It's also not surprising, then, that when women are measured on Kohlberg's scale, they register very low. Women are most frequently ranked in the 3rd stage of moral development, one in which morality is perceived in interpersonal terms, and goodness is equated with helping and pleasing others. This description is consistent with Gilligan's further research on women's perceptions of morality, and also with many traditional perceptions of femininity. Kohlberg sees this paradigm as subordinate and inferior to later stages of male development, in which individuation is more important than connection, the restriction, and morality is seen primarily as fairness, as the restriction of one's own aggression in order to respect the rights of others. Gilligan suggests that the two perceptions of morality should be seen as equal and complementary. The predominantly feminine conception of morality as concerned with care, centering moral development around the understanding of responsibility in relationships, is one that should balance the predominantly masculine understanding of morality as fairness, of tying moral development to the understanding of rights and rules. If this were to occur, beyond the merely personal, academic, institutional, it could change our participation in world affairs dramatically. We would not be able to justify economically or in any other terms, the destruction of tons of wheat or other produce when millions of people in and outside of our borders are starving. Our sense of responsibility and care might ally us more closely with such organizations as the Peace Corps, the Red Cross, UNICEF, and many others, maybe turning our hearts away from the aggressive policing military mentality that is currently part of our national affairs, part of our national policy, part of our national philosophy. If we are to root our moral decisions not only in the hierarchies of abstract laws, as a rights-oriented mentality is prone to do, but also to soften our judgments with consideration of context, of the circumstances of every situation, we would not be blinded so easily by such dicta as the Monroe Doctrine, through which we too often justify aggression and tyranny in the name of fighting against it. My recommendations for integrating the principles of what has too long been labeled and dismissed as feminine morality lie in a few very idealistic and necessarily personal convictions. As citizens of one of the world's most powerful nations, I believe we must curtail our impulse to coerce. We must use our strength to enhance non-threatening, positive relationships with other countries of every political persuasion and of every size and threatening capacity. I'm encouraged by our recent associations with the Soviet Union. I don't believe that after visiting the Soviet Union, speaking with its citizens and speaking with its leader, Reagan can any longer simplistically dismiss a nation of millions of people as an evil empire. I truly believe that the example of little Samantha Smith goes far beyond a charming incident in international affairs. I believe that the most ominous implication of our ignorance, our national United States popular ignorance of other countries, of other nations, of the geography of the world, of the cultures of those countries, I think the most frightening thing about that is that we do not know the people. We don't know our brothers and sisters on this planet. We cannot easily kill the people we know. It's almost impossible to destroy the people whom we've fed, who we've loved, and who we have nurtured, whether those people are in a nursing home, whether they are in our family, whether they are brothers and sisters in our community, or whether they are people thousands of miles away across continents and oceans. The fundamental precept of Christianity, love in its deepest personal form, applies not only in our homes, communities, and nursing facilities, but also in our national and international affairs. We must generate a mentality in our personal lives, in our religion, and in our nation that sustains life, disrupts static fate, and abhors torment and death under any rationale. If this is feminine, and if this is truly part of the feminine mind, part of the feminine psyche, then let us give women a voice. If it is part of all of us, and if it is part of our hearts and spirit gender, then let us do as Goethe suggests, and let the woman in us all show us the way. Thank you.
The time is up, so let me just invite you to come and hear me tomorrow morning, where I'll be talking about peace. For you who may not be able to do that, let me make two brief points as we think about Beyond the Summit and the hopefulness of our time. The scriptures are full of the promise that at the end of the world the wicked will be burned. I believe that. I don't know how literal it is. It's clear to me it will not be through an atomic holocaust, because it clearly indicates it will be a very selective kind of thing. And those who will be preserved will be one from a family and two from a city. Hugh Nibley has written a marvelous essay analyzing those scriptures, particularly in the Book of Mormon, which appeared in the peace issue of BYU Studies, which is not an oxymoron. We really did have one, edited by Gary Browning, that appeared in Winter 85, and I recommend you look at it if you can. Not just because it has an essay on fast, not weapons, by me. He convincingly shows that the wicked, those who will be destroyed, are precisely the ones who think they are the good guys and are not repenting. And the ones who will be preserved are the ones who do not make those judgments. I think the best thing we can do, each of us, is to try to pick up on the spirit we've had expressed here today and cultivate in our hearts, for all people, even Ollie North and Ronald Reagan and others that some of us think we're better than, that reminder that there are no good guys and bad guys. We're all sinners, and we need to think about that and repent and think about what we need to repent of, whoever it is we're angry at, and whoever extent we think we're the good guys because we're peace activists or whatever we are. One other suggestion. Well, maybe I could just follow that up by a reminder. We have much to repent of. President J. Reuben Clark, in an editorial immediately after the dropping of the bomb in Hiroshima, said it was the most terrible thing that was done in the Second World War, and that his children and grandchildren would pay the penalty to the utmost farthing. I think he spoke prophetically. And we're paying the penalty in moral decline in our nation. We live in a nation, and we're all part of it. However, maybe we think we're the good guys because we're trying to say something about peace. We lend our support by paying our taxes, if nothing else. We live in a country where we spend every minute $2 million on destructive arms, and in that time, 24 people die of starvation in this world. I cannot believe that Christ can look on that with the least degree of allowance. We are paying now to the utmost farthing, I believe. And one way we are paying is we have become, I believe, the most warlike nation on earth. The chief threat to the peace of the earth. Because at a time when Russia is withdrawing from Afghanistan and has renounced the Brezhnev Doctrine and is making proposals to us about peacemaking efforts that we made years ago but which we are now refusing because Russia is making them. At that very time, we are, both parties, both presidential candidates, continuing to promote the Reagan Doctrine, our right to interfere in the sovereign affairs of other states in our vital interests, a damnable doctrine, explicitly renounced by a modern prophet, President David O. Mukwege, who said, whatever justification there may ever be for going to war, one never is to enforce on another government, a people, a government we prefer no matter how much better the government. We tried to do that in Vietnam. We did it in Grenada. And we're trying to do it in Nicaragua. And it is evil. And we are part of that nation. And we lend our support to whatever degree we do not fight it with every means that we have, I believe. One positive suggestion. We cannot find peace simply by stopping doing things. Repentance is a positive process. We've got to initiate some things. We need to go to Mars with Russia. We need to cooperate. We need to join them in solving the problems of world hunger. We need to propose that to them and start setting an example rather than spending all of our enormous political and diplomatic energy in trying to outwit them and get an advantage on them, which we do. One of the most discouraging things I ever heard from a young Mormon, a member of the State Department, talking about the privilege he had of sitting in on a brainstorming session before the summit to propose ideas to Reagan that he could use there that might get some advantage with the Soviets or make some progress. I asked him, did anyone in that session suggest that we do something to cooperate with them? To solve some world problem, to build trust between each other. He hung his head and said, no. We were only thinking of things we could do to compete with them, to get some advantage, some diplomatic advantage over them. Until we change our thinking, we'll never find peace. If we took merely 5% of our military budget, and no one can agree within 5% about what we need for national security, if we took only 5%, we could pay each year for 3 million of our citizens to live in Russia and not only walk through the towns and villages and build friendship, but to live there and to learn the language and to become friends. Can't we move ourselves even to that small diminution of our enormous outlay for weapons? That would be a very small repentance, but might start the way. Thank you.
We have a few minutes for questions. First, I want to tell you that we have Ed Firmage's Reynolds Lecture, Ends and Means of Conflict, for you after the session. And Dr. England's paper will be given tomorrow in this room at 9:45. Isn't that right? So go ahead and open for questions. Go ahead. Okay, the first part of that question.
I'd be happy to respond to that.
Please, we've been dialoguing for years. I'd love to have you give him my answer.
No, go ahead. There's a lot of difference between talking strongly and, quote, insisting and dropping bombs. That's a very different kind of hammer. And Christ used verbal force constantly. And love can be tough, and it can be insistent, and it can point out the truth in very tough ways, but that's very different from violence. Even Christ's great example of violence, which people use to try to discount his teachings about loving your enemies, his driving the money changers in the temple, did not kill people. It's a very different kind of thing, and whatever his reason for that, whether it was because he was still learning, as Alma 7 tells us, he had to learn how to be our Savior, and made a mistake, I don't know. But the point is, Russia lived for 30 years under the most severe hammer, incredible nuclear superiority. We had missiles in Turkey aimed at their cities before they had anything, and they did not capitulate. Force has not made them become friendly. What has happened is a leader has finally emerged with enough historical sense to realize that our continual escalation and imitation of each other has gotten us nowhere and is destroying his economy. We apparently haven't got sense enough to realize that yet.
May I add one thing that's to me important as Latter-day Saints, and I don't think limited to that, just that, and that is I recall President Kimball asking the members of this church to pray for the softening of the hearts of the leaders of the nations of earth, that the gospel might roll forth. And I believe that was in the early 70s, about the time he dedicated the land of Poland to the teaching of the gospel. Now, it's taken 16 years. I'm always impressed that the Lord doesn't seem to be in as much of a hurry as we are. But I have, as I've, in the intervening years from that statement and that plea, a great faith in the result that would come if, in fact, all people everywhere prayed for the softening of the hearts of those who might appear, again, politically an enemy, humanly our brother. And I have great faith in that.
And if we really try, it might even happen to our own leaders by the next election.
Okay. I suggest it happened to Neville Chamberlain brought back a white paper from Hitler and what happened thereafter.
Could I respond to that?
It's almost the 50th anniversary of the Chamberlain supposed debacle. I suggest you read an article by Richard Bushman in the last dialogue about President Brown, who was mission president in England when that happened, and who wrote two editorials for the Millennial Star defending Chamberlain and pointing out that he was doing exactly what he should, the best Christian thing and the most effective thing in the long run. Did it save us from Hitler that later we were tough? No. A madman is not stopped because we use Christian principles always. But we were right to use the Christian principles. And not only were we right, we were more effective because of what Chamberlain did in following the Christian principles of negotiation with Hitler, even though Hitler trampled on them, gave us a moral unity in that war which was essential to our winning it, and more important than the arms, and gave us time to prepare. Chamberlain was not wrong. I'm here as one of the few to tell you that that's one of the great errors of our thinking, that what he did was wrong. He was right, and a man who became a prophet saw it and wrote it at the time.
Well, but Churchill wrong then?
I think so.
It seems to me in the 1930s, Churchill was taking a stand against Hitler, which the British government did not back up. And if they had taken a stand of not disarming and of opposing Hitler and of using some strategic pressure on him, things might have been different.
I don't think we have any historical example to suggest they would be. Force never produces anything but force and counterforce.
But Hitler was encouraged by the lack of backbone.
Forced
it in
the Second World War.
Let me suggest something. This is becoming kind of an annual thing where we have at least one of these kind of panels or a paper that is pro-peace or something of that nature. And I'm in favor of them. And many of your arguments are well-reasoned and very good. And I'm really impressed. However, if you are missing a major advantage, a major option in what you're doing, you are only showing one side in these panels. You must have the opposite. What was dialogue all about? You haven't got a dialogue, you've got a monologue. Have a dialogue. You've got good points. Everything you're saying is very good, but there is no one to represent the other view. Find somebody who can represent the other view.
I thought that each of us perhaps indicated we did at one time represent that other view, but did in fact change find reasons for change. I represented the other view for a lifetime. I simply say that so that you understand that we perhaps did not start out as children with this view, but have come with what we feel is a sense of maturity to this view, having always perhaps espoused the other side first.
That's fine, but we haven't heard the other side yet.
We're hearing it now.
No, you're not. You're hearing that occasional suggestion. You need somebody who has a reasoned position, has taken time to think about it. That's what you need, and you haven't got that. You got a couple of guys raising their arm and saying, I don't agree. I mean, that's not a reasoned position.
I beg your pardon?
You're not getting reasoned people who have taken time to think carefully about the other view. And that's what you need. You need somebody to say the other side carefully and reasoned and well-reasoned. Not just a guy like me raising his hand. I haven't thought about this well enough.
Well, go home and do that, and maybe they'll surprise you next year and let you present the other side, well thought out and reasoned.
We'll take that into consideration. Thank you. Go ahead.
I would just like to put forth what is moving in me as a woman on this issue is that the Mother Earth is being threatened. And I, for one, have seen and met some of the most powerful women in this movement that I think I've ever met, and they are genuinely stirred from a deep place because of the threat to the earth. They are the children bearers, and they see other generations. I want to join with every man and every woman who can help bridge the gap that has been going on over past generations, and that's just my insight into the feminine thrust right now. I think it's good.
Could I just say one thing about that to defend us men, if you will? I'm not sure it's a defense. It's interesting to me that those qualities that we call feminine in our culture, compassion, kindness, patience, nurturing, so forth, are precisely the qualities that uniquely define Christ, who said to us in the Book of Mormon, "What manner of men ought ye to be, even as I am?" The answer is not to turn the problem over to women, but for men to become like Christ.
We'd like to thank you for coming, especially thank our panel.
Thank you.